With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between. We also wanted to let you know that you can now join our Patreon program. It starts from £5 a month to £10 or £20, depending on what you want. Each tier allows you slightly different levels of access. Depending on which one you choose, you can enjoy early access to podcast episodes, exclusive member benefits, merchandise, shout outs, and your chance to feature on one of our shows. Any support you can give us is massively appreciated and will help us grow and continue to bring cool content to race fans all over the world. You can find the link on our socials, just search for Motormouth or go to patreon.com. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and you can also leave us a review. Download the Motormouth app where you can get live race times, exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy.
Welcome to episode 19 of the Motormouth podcast. Alongside me, as always, with his dulcet tones and manicured facial hair, is Mr. Harry Benjamin. How are you?
Hello. I'm okay. I'm still in my cupboard. I'm still in lockdown, but spirits are high.
Good. I would usually ask what you've been up to, but to be honest, you've probably been up to a whole lot of nothing.
Well, I'll have you know, I've been moving the furniture around in my house because you know what they say, a cluttered house is a cluttered mind.
Is it messing with your feng shui?
And I've now remove things about, I feel like I can actually be a bit more productive.
A healthy brain, good. Well, look, shall I introduce today's guest?
Go on then.
So once again, we're recording remotely and we're joined by yet another top racing driver. Sebastian Buemi is currently racing in Formula E and is one of the championship's most successful drivers. The man from Switzerland is a championship winner with more wins than any other driver. He began racing in karts and then onto the German Formula BMW Championship in 2004, claiming third in his debut season, and it'd be 2009 before he'd make his first Formula One appearance via Formula 3 Euro Series and GP2. Like one of our previous guests, Brendan Hartley, he caught the attention of Toro Rosso to make him a full-blown Formula One racer. As we know, he now makes a living racing in Formula E alongside teammate Oliver Rowland, but also competes in the World Endurance Championship with Toyota, where he's a championship winner, and can add the famous Le Mans 24-hour race to his list of growing accomplishments. Ladies and gentlemen, a big Motormouth welcome to Sebastian Buemi. Sebastian, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Good, and you?
Very well, thank you. Where are you joining us from today? You've got a collection of cars in a cabinet and trophies behind you. Are you at home? Where have we found you?
I'm at home. Yeah, just moved house something like 6 months ago. So I'm finally getting everything together, and it was kind of a good opportunity, by staying home. But no, I'm good. I'm at home trying to take the positive out of this, situation. But so far, so good.
And you've got two kids as well. Are you doing a bit of homeschooling?
Yeah. The small one is obviously still a bit small, but the bigger one, yeah, we're doing. So it's not so easy, but we're trying to do the best we can.
How old are your kids?
Four and two.
Four and two. I've got same as me. I've got a 2-year-old and a soon-to-be 5-year-old. And they're both both hyperactive boys, and keeping them amused in a house during lockdown is not easy at all. So I feel your pain.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I saw Seb on your Twitter. I think that you did a sort of almost assault course with your two kids around your house, which looked like it was a good way to kill the time.
Yeah, trying to kill the time the best we can. So some days are better than some others, but today it's good weather outside, so we're trying to spend some time outside as much as we can.
Well, let's talk about you and your racing career and your life so far. So let's. Well, like we do with all our guests, we like to take it right back to the beginning and how it started for you. What was the thing in your mind which said, yes, I want to be a racing driver? When did that start?
Well, it started pretty early. I basically got a go-kart for Christmas from my dad when I was just turning 5 years old. So, I can't remember so much. I do remember that Christmas when I got the go-kart, but then from there on, you know, I don't remember my life without go-karts or racing. So somehow it was kind of obvious from the beginning that I wanted to become a professional racing driver. But back then, you know, you are full of motivation and you think it's going to be easy. And as you grow, you understand it's a bit more complex than you initially thought.
Was there motorsport in the family already?
My grandfather did Le Mans in 1960. From my mother's side, and obviously my parents, they have a dealership since 40 years, so somehow, you know, I was kind of already a little bit in it from the beginning, but my dad did not race himself, so it kind of jumped a generation, but still, you know, I always wanted to be a racing driver from the beginning, and my dad was a big fan, so somehow it started pretty naturally.
So was it general racing or was Formula One the dream?
Formula One. You know, as a kid, you watch Formula One with your dad on a Sunday. And, you know, I remember waking up with him and they had the race in Australia and watching it at 6 in the morning. It was always a dream, but unfortunately, you know, sometimes you don't realize how difficult it actually is. And it's kind of good because otherwise you might not even try, you know, and then obviously we enjoyed, we spent lots of weekends, you know, with the family, my brother, my mother, my dad, you know, going on go-kart circuit with the camping car and just staying there and sleeping there. And we enjoyed the time as well, but back then, I did not realize, you know, how complex it would be. And go-kart went pretty well. I won lots of races and championships. So somehow, you know, it went quite good.
Did you when you got in the go-kart for the first time in a competitive race, were you immediately on the pace and thought, yes, you know, this is something I'm clearly good at? Or did it take you a bit of time to start getting those wins and podiums?
I think the first year I didn't win any races, but I was something like 7.5, and I was competing against guys that were 11 to 12 years old, 10, 11 years old. So back then it's pretty difficult. But the second year when I was 8, 8.5, I started winning lots of races. So I would say it took a year. Also because my dad was my mechanic, so we had to learn lots of small things, you know, that makes a difference. But I would say, yeah, the second year when I turned 8, I started winning quite a lot of races from there on.
So at this point, it's your dad is your mechanic. Who is he also guiding you through these early years? So when you leave karting and you start thinking about where to go next, is it your dad who's the main driver here in terms of finding your next race seat?
Yeah, he is. Fortunately, we always discussed it together. You know, pretty early on, I was really aware of the situation financially and what we could do and not do. We took the decision together to do the Formula BMW because we thought at the time that it was the best platform. You know, when I moved there in 2004, it was one of the best championships for the 14.5 years old. You know, I was just turning 15 or not yet 15. And it was one of the first championships you could do at that age. So then obviously, you know, I raced with Vettel back then, Hülkenberg, those guys, you know, that were good in go-karts. So trying to find the same platform and compete against the same guys again. And then very early in 2004, I got the call from Red Bull, and obviously Red Bull decided to sign me on, and then that was the very crucial part, because I knew that I wouldn't be able to compete in Formula BMW over more than one season. So I had to somehow find someone that would finance it.
Was it a lifeline at the time, or were you able to keep progressing up the ranks in motorsport?
To be honest, that was my first year in motorsport, so my first year in Formula BMW. And pretty early, I had very good results. Like, I had pole positions in front of Vettel. That was obviously in his second year. And because Red Bull back then had something like three or four athletes in the category, they were obviously looking at the other guys. And I was the youngest. So somehow, you know, I don't think back then it was a big risk for Red Bull to take me on. And for me, it was a big opportunity, because I knew that if I would compete properly and I would win, I knew I would have the opportunity to go up to Formula One, you know, and I would be placed in a decent team where I could obviously deliver. So it was not every day easy, but let's say I knew that if the performance was there, I would get the opportunity, which it's not always the case when you look at some other careers.
And that opportunity did eventually come about. So when did that first Formula One chance come?
I think my first test was 2007. I was winning lots of races in Formula 3 Euro Series. I had to replace a Red Bull driver in GP2. He had broken his wrist, Arno Müller, and I basically did very well in my first race. I didn't know Monaco, I didn't know the car, and I qualified on the second row, finished in the points, and clearly that was kind of crucial, because it gave me directly the opportunity to get a Formula One test. And then I became the reserve driver in 2008, and I ended up racing in 2009. So somehow it all went quite smoothly, let's say.
How did it feel getting into a Formula One car that first time? Obviously, you've raced in GP2. You've had some good wins there, even one where I think I read you came back from 21st on the grid in France to win on a drying track. But stepping into a Formula One car for the first time, try and tell us how that felt when you started turning wheels and feeling the forces, the brakes, the acceleration. Was it like nothing you've experienced before in a car?
It's pretty special, because I do remember that first test very well. You know, I was in Spain, and the first time they turned up the engine, you know, it was not yet an hybrid engine, it was a normal V8 engine, and it's pretty shocking when you sit in the car and you hear the engine, and then you pull out of the garage and you want to upshift so quickly, but the engine back then were revving up to 20,000 RPM. So I think the first time you upshift, you don't even see the first lights, you know, you're not even at 15,000 RPM, you're already thinking you need to upshift. But you know, it was a pretty emotional day as well, you know, because somehow it feels like, okay, I've done part of my dream, which was to obviously compete in Formula One. I mean, drive in Formula One.
Yeah.
And then you directly think about the next one. You don't want to get out, you know, you want to drive again the car. And in terms of performances, it's pretty impressive, because everything feels so good, you know, so much better than anything else you've experienced before. You know, the vibrations are gone, the grip is amazing, everything is just better and a lot better than anything else you've ever driven. So yeah, it's a nice opportunity to get to drive those cars.
And that must have been a very emotional moment for your family and your father as well, having bought you that first car, been your mechanic and by your side all this time, to see you take to the track in a Formula One car. Must have been a very emotional moment for him as well.
Yes, it was. Actually, at that first test, you know, it was an aero test, so it was not there. But at my second test, it was a proper test on the racetrack, and there it was. But yeah, because, you know, now that I have kids, I'm always thinking, would I do the same than what he did for me? Would I be actually ready to sacrifice so much? And I'm asking this question all the time, you know, because it's pretty crazy what they did. I mean, many parents, when you listen to the stories of their kids, they did lots of sacrifices. But, you know, knowing in the situation we were, to go all in like this, you know, he sold a lot of things that he had. You know, we he sold all the cars that he had, he sold everything, and he told me, okay, we're going to do 1 year. If you don't perform, if we don't get results, that's going to be it, you know? So then to finally make it there, I think it's pretty emotional for everyone in the family, including, you know, my brother, my mother, everyone, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a big commitment parents make. We were talking to Brendan Hartley last week, and he was telling us how his parents at 16 years old put him on an aeroplane to the UK to Germany to start his European racing career. And he was thinking now as an adult, what were they thinking? Like me as a parent now thinking, God, you know, to send your kid off to the other side of the world to embark on a racing career that's going to cost you millions of pounds for the rest of your life is an amazing thing to do. So,
I remember when he came to Europe, actually, because... He came to Europe to do a Red Bull test in Estoril in Portugal, and I was a reference driver. You know, Helmut wanted me to do a lap in each car, like Formula Renault, Formula 3. And those new guys that were not yet Red Bull drivers, they were basically assessed against me. So I remember exactly the first time I saw him, and I think he just came from New Zealand. That was his first trip to Europe. So
did you wonder
did you see him first or his hair first?
Yeah, I was going to say his hair is something else.
But I think back then when he really came, it was not as bad as it got, you know. It got a lot worse later on.
Yeah.
He told us to give you a hard time, so we'll make sure we throw in a couple of difficult questions on his behalf.
Yeah. Now that your test there's you know, you're testing and being a reserve for Red Bull and Toro Rosso, then that Toro Rosso seat comes about in 2009. That's, you know, that must change everything, because there's one thing that's testing the cars, and now you are a confirmed racing driver for the 2009 season. What's your mentality going into that? Did you feel the pressure? Because, you know, a lot is made of the Red Bull driver program and Helmut Marko. How are you dealing with all that? And what's your relationship like with Helmut?
Well, it's pretty good. You know, I know him now since I'm 14, so more than half of my year of my life. Yeah, I know him since 17 years now. And I never had any problem with him. It was always pretty straightforward. And I was really thankful to Red Bull in general for giving me the opportunity. I knew, you know, I had to perform. And the first year went actually very well, because I scored points in my first race. I scored very well at the end of the year. Bourdais, he was obviously a very good driver as my teammate, you know, a lot older than me. And I did, you know, perform much better than him. So let's say my first year went very well. And also from time to time, you know, back then we had, we could obviously copy the Red Bull car. It was allowed. And we were obviously very much behind in terms of copying, because we back then the double diffuser came on, and we didn't have the money to obviously do it directly. But once I had a pretty similar car, not exactly the same one, we were able to obviously perform and be always in Q3. So the first year went very well, you know. It became a lot harder after, when the regulation changed, and Toro Rosso, which was not really a proper manufacturer, had to step up and become a proper factory. It became more difficult in the second season. But the first season went well, and honestly, I was quite relaxed. Obviously, I wanted to do well, and the first race is always something special. You get to Australia, and you're going to play big for the first time. You know, it's no testing. It's really for real, and it's not so easy, but I did enjoy very much my time back then, and I tried to, you know, think about it this way. And with Helmut, it was always pretty good.
No, and that's probably, you know, you get your shot in Formula One. I suppose it's what everyone dreams of, and not everyone gets that dream. And you're in Formula One until the end of 2011. How was that final season with Toro Rosso? Obviously, it was, you know, a really big midfield battle during those years with the likes of Force India and Sauber. How did you see that final season? And was this, could you see the end coming?
To be honest, the last season, it's my best season, just because we didn't see it really in the results. But the last four races, I was constantly in the points, and I had only mechanical failures. I had an engine failure in India while I was running seventh. I had an hydraulic issue in Abu Dhabi while I was running sixth. And I think I lost the wheel in Suzuka once I was when I was P8. So it could have looked really strong. And I mean, for back then, because I would have constantly be between P6 and P9 in last four races, and somehow I always retired. And three quarter of the job was back then done. So, you know, back then they had kind of let me think that it was going to continue, and I was not happy with all the bad luck I had, but I was quite confident it would continue. Then obviously things changed, and I had to accept and move on. So to be honest, a bit disappointed, because I felt like I deserve to have those results towards the end of the season, when most of the job was done. You know, once you stop for the second time and you fuel to finish, you know, it's more or less the race is done. And it was hard not to get those results. But, you know, sometimes in life, things like that happen, and you have to move on. And then and obviously, pretty quickly, I moved to WEC. And then Formula E.
Yeah, and WEC obviously has been a tremendous success for you. You've seen a lot of success with Toyota, two-time champion and Le Mans winner. How did the WEC seat come about? And that must have been a hugely pleasing period of your career.
To be honest, not so many people know, but back in 2009, I was... Obviously, Red Bull was aware, but I was discussing with Toyota to join the Formula One team after my first season in Toro Rosso.
Right.
And to be honest, it was pretty close before they decided to stop Formula One. I was pretty confident I would be driving there, to be honest. So I knew the people from the team very well. You know, I had a few meetings with them, and obviously, the people deciding, I knew them, you know. And Pascal Vasselon back then was a technical director. I had a lot of discussion with him, obviously, about joining the team. And then they stopped Formula One, and those people stayed in the team, you know. So when they managed to get the WEC program going, obviously, he's one of the first guy I gave a call to. I knew I would remain as a reserve driver for Red Bull, and obviously I gave him a call, and he offered me a seat directly, you know.
Wow.
So back then the problem was that Toyota was not completely committed to WEC. We started with one car, then obviously we would have two cars in Le Mans, so I was in the second car because the first three drivers were already signed. And then obviously they stepped up massively, because the next year they came with two cars for the whole championship. And then somehow, you know, it became a very important program within Toyota. And then obviously they stayed there since now 2012. So it's a long time now.
It also seems like since you joined in 2012, obviously WEC and Le Mans has been around, you know, in various guises for years. But in terms of sort of general awareness and perhaps TV coverage, it really seems to amped up since 2012. How was it for you? Did you have to sort of retrain your mind with joining WEC after F1? Or you know, we were talking to Brendan as well, obviously driving for Porsche back in for WEC. And he said, you know, it operates at the exact same high level.
Yeah, so to be honest, back then, Toyota had been out of Formula One for 2 years only. Mm. So somehow, obviously, the technology would have had improved a little bit over those 2 years, but the way they were operating was very similar to what they were doing back in Formula One. So for me, I didn't see a big difference between them and what I knew at Toro Rosso. You know, they were even a bigger team than what I had at Toro Rosso in Formula One. So to be honest, they operated at a very high level. And then with Audi and Porsche joining, you can imagine that they were spending lots of money in terms of marketing. So they were inviting lots of journalists to the races. And somehow that basically helped massively the WEC to get more exposure. And also 2012 is the first year of the World Championship being back. So for everyone, it's much easier to sell that you're going to race in the World Championship than what it was before, the ELMS, ILMS. I don't know how they called it back then, but it was very complex and not easy to understand. And yeah, I think it was kind of a golden years for the WEC because they had three big manufacturers. At some point, we even had Nissan joining the fight. So it was very big, you know. And clearly, I think more people heard about the WEC than they did before just because of that.
And how do you see the WEC now and going forward? Because obviously there's a lot of changes technically with the regulations and the LMP1s and the hypercars. How do you see it going forward in the next few years?
To be honest now, with what's happening with the coronavirus, I don't really know because things may change. You know, big manufacturer may reassess their decisions. They might change idea. I don't know. But to be honest, obviously, we had the good years where people were willing to spend lots of money and the cars were pretty amazing because back then, just before the Formula One cars went to the big tires and everything, we were very close to them in terms of lap time. So it was pretty impressive. Obviously, now they are, again, much faster. But how I see it, I think some good people are running it. You know, they have some good ideas. And I think if they manage to communicate in the next few days, few weeks, the convergence with IMSA, you know, the American Championship, that if you have a car, you can compete in both championships. With the regulation we now know, I think that the budget, the operating budget will be quite low, and I mean low in a certain way, but I think you will interest a lot of new brands, and I think it could well be very good within the next 2 years. I think it's going to take a bit of time because first of all, the regulation needs to come into place, and before 2022, it's going to be difficult, this we know. But I see a pretty good future for the WEC from 2022 onwards, let's say.
And you've obviously, jumping forward a little bit, you are a winner of the famous Le Mans 24-hour race. You're also a world champion in the World Endurance Championship. Two massive highlights of your career. Can you put one on top of the other, or is winning the championship the one that stands out for you, or perhaps standing at the top of the podium at the Le Mans 24-hour takes it for you? What's been your highlight in your WEC career?
Well, to be honest, I think at the end it's pretty clear for me that it is Le Mans. I tell you why, because championship, I won it with Davidson Anthony in 2014. And it was only my second full season in the WEC, you know. Somehow, okay, it was always difficult, and Porsche and Audi were already there. But I wouldn't say we won it easily, but we basically won it well. Le Mans, it took a long time. It took like 6, 7, I don't know how many attempts. And after what happened in 2016, where we had this issue in the last lap, you know, we had done an amazing race, and we were beating Porsche, Audi, everyone, basically. And we had this issue in the last lap. It was so hard to accept. And then we came back in 17 again, leading and, I mean, being very good. And again, we had an issue. And then finally in 18, we won it. So I think because of what happened in the past, Le Mans is a bigger, for me, personally, a bigger achievement just because I went through lots of tough moments there.
Yeah, it made you work for it.
Yes, yeah, properly, yeah.
Yeah. But then in 2014, Formula E comes about. Now talk us through your journey into finding out what that was, you know, this all electric racing championship. I know it's been discussed left, right and center how people thought it would be, you know, absolutely terrible. Who's gonna, you know, what's this electric F1? No, I don't want to see any of that. But you've been in it from the very beginning. What's your take on it? It has progressed massively, especially in the last couple of years. You obviously started out with Renault eDems, it's now turned into Nissan. Talk us through your journey and into Formula E.
To be honest, I joined Formula E more because I wanted to join Jean-Paul Driot, you know, the owner of Dams. I was a very good friend of him since a long time because I knew him since 2005, so for more or less 10 years. And we always said, okay, if one day we can do something together, we will do it. So back then, you know, I obviously looked at the car and looked at what it was going to be, but I was just happy to join the team. I wanted to work with him more than initially I wanted to be part of Formula E. And then of course, things went very well and the championship grew. I think the championship's been quite lucky, to be honest, with what happened politically, the Dieselgate and all the manufacturer joining. The technology, has improved quite a lot. The speed of the cars, everything has improved, but it's not like day and night compared to season one. What's clear is basically that it has earned its place on the motorsport planet, you know, and people respect Formula E much more than they did in the past. So I think I was quite lucky to be joining such a good team from the beginning.
And you are officially the most successful Formula E driver out there, right? You've won more races, more poles and so on. What's your secret? Is there a style that you've adapted to do so well in Formula E? Or do you think you just, the way you drove suited that series?
Well, I think it suited the car from the beginning, because from the first test onwards, I was quick. But, you know, people tend to forget that it's not only down to the driver, it's down to the team, to the engineers, to everyone involved. And if you look, you know, in season three, I won six races, but had to miss two races because of a wet clash and I lost the championship. And last year, I won just one race. And the year before, I didn't win any race. So the problem is you need to grab the opportunity while it's there, and it changes from year to year. Sometimes you have the material and the package to win, sometimes not. And I think that, you know, I don't consider myself like people would do, like, oh, yeah, I am much better. That's why I won all those races. I won those races because I had a good team and it worked well together. And now it's a bit more difficult. We had a very strong end to last season when we finally finished second. I finished second in the championship, where I was still P13th after a few races. So yeah, I just want to highlight the fact that it's a teamwork, you know, and you don't win just because you are a better driver.
That's very, very, very humble of you. But I'm sure your team will be very, very pleased to hear that. And yes, certainly your comeback in season five was probably unexpected, even for you, I'd imagine, after the start of the season, not going according to plan, then to come back and finish the championship in second place. That must have been pleasing.
Yeah, it was a kind of relief because, first of all, I wanted to get that win since a long time, and I wanted to get it for Jean-Paul. Back then, he was in the hospital, not doing good, you know, and he managed to watch the race and watch us win. But it was tough because we were quick. We were always quick. If you look at season five, I'm the best qualifier by far. I think I have a starting position average better than P3, and it's by far the best one, but somehow every race something was happening. Either I was unlucky, I had a technical failure or mistake or whatever. Obviously, everybody knows we had a special package with a twin motor, and it was pretty complex to get it together. But at the end, it started to click, and it's a shame that, you know, I was leading Paris when I got punctured. Without that puncture, I would have won the championship. So it's like that, you know, but I'm happy with the comeback we had, because P2 at the end was pretty good.
Is it nice? Does it make a difference to be a part of a championship from the very beginning?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm happy to say that I was there from the beginning, but it doesn't really change my life today. So,
well, here's a question then for you. Formula E, Formula One or WEC, if you had to pick one?
As a pure fan of motorsport, I would still pick Formula One.
Yeah.
But as a racing driver, I would pick Formula One only if I had the opportunity to be in a good team.
Yeah.
Because to be in a team that cannot be better than P10 or P12 or P8, it's great to be doing Formula One for a couple of seasons, three seasons, just to experience the fact that you've been in Formula One. It was your dream. You made it, but I wouldn't say it becomes boring, but you want to be able to win. You know, we are competitive. I'm very competitive, and I want to get the opportunity to fight for wins. Mm. And in Formula E, of course, you have better teams and teams that are not so good. But let's say, other than maybe two teams, most of them, they'll get within the year the opportunity to fight for the win. So you can be out of 12 teams, you can be in 10 teams and get the opportunity to fight for a win, which is absolutely not the case when you are in Formula One.
Yeah.
Formula One, you have maybe maximum four, six cars some years where you can win. And it's nearly impossible. And all the rest, they just compete for P6 to P10. And it's really difficult to accept. In the WEC, it's a bit somehow the same, because when we had Porsche and Audi and you come to Le Mans and you are 2 seconds off the pace, you have no chance.
Yeah, because
over 24 hours, even if you have a better start, they're going to pass you back, and that's going to be it. So I really enjoy the WEC for the team spirit, for racing in Le Mans, for racing through the night, all those kind of aspects. I love Formula E for the fact that you get the opportunity to fight at the front and you get the opportunity to win. And I still like Formula One because they are the fastest cars out there, you know. So it's very difficult to pick one up. It depends on the situation.
That's a good answer.
You make a fair point. Yeah.
Now, I think it's time that Sebastian, we put your knowledge to the test. We have a small quiz for you, which your friend Brendan Hartley, I believe, is leading at the moment. I'll pass over to Harry to introduce our famous quiz.
Yes, this is the Motormouths quiz, Seb. It's notoriously the hardest quiz in motorsport, but partly because no one really knows what the correct answer is. So Brendan is currently top with 12.5 points. Now, I have got 4 clips for you, and they are all related to you. Each clip is worth 3 points. So you've got to answer 3 questions for me within each one, and then there is a bonus question at the end. So if you get everything, you could get 13 points and go to the top, but I'm warning you, it's very, very difficult. So let's kick off with clip number 1. I want you to think about what's happening, where, and anything else.
Here it comes.
Was that enough?
I think I should be careful, but I think it was in Fuji, in Toyota, when I fell asleep in the car, no?
Yes, it absolutely is. So that was...
Oh, I love that.
You probably sleep in the car, the Fuji 6 hours. But who woke you up?
Can we?
No, it wasn't. It was Anthony.
No, but it's Anthony that...
Kamui does come over.
Yeah, he comes over. Yeah, yeah.
No, I'll give you half a point for Kamui.
But to be honest, I was asleep. But the radio check thing is a made up stuff. You know, he didn't talk to me like that. You know?
Oh, was he not? Oh,
no. Yeah, no, it's just the work putting it together. You know.
Oh, I thought I didn't think that was too perfect to be true.
Yeah.
But all right, well, I'll give you 2.5 for that one. Okay, let's move on to clip number 2. Have a listen to this.
Here it comes.
We're riding on board. What happens here is braking towards 100-meter board.
Oh!
And both.
Yeah,
it's your mate Anthony again. So what's happening, China, where and when?
China 2010, I lose the front wheels at the end of the straight, no?
Yeah, but Brendan was telling us he still takes the mick out of you for that, because he had a very similar crash his year at Silverstone, I think it was. That is still one of the biggest crashes in
terrifying
in recent history.
Yeah, I don't think it's a big crash, it's just a very spectacular one.
It just looks very dramatic.
The speed,
both,
yeah.
What was your first thought when both wheels came off?
Shit.
Yeah, to be honest, you have no time to think. You know, I'm still steering if you look at the video.
Yeah.
And so I have no front wheels, you know, it's kind of... you have no time to react, to be honest.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, well done. You get a full 3 points for that, if that makes up for the crash. Let's go to clip number 3.
Here we go.
Coming down into turn 3, into the left-hander, he goes side by side. Oh!
So that's, of course, good friend Jack Nicholls, Formula E commentary. What is happening there?
Turn 3 goes into... He didn't give me much, huh?
We've got him. One. I think we've got him.
Can you replay?
One more time. Here we go.
Coming down into turn 3, into the left-hander, he goes side by side.
I like the scream at the end.
Side by side, turn 3. Ah, yeah, it's London when Lucas hit me or not.
Yes, correct. That is, yeah, that was for the fight for the championship. And what year? Can you give me a year?
Yeah, it's when I won it. So I think it's 2016.
Absolutely correct.
July, yeah.
That is a full 3 points. That has got to be one of the most memorable moments in your career when that happened.
Not in a good way.
Are you and Lucas, do you get on now? Or are you sort of, is it colleagues?
A bit better. We had some very tough times even after that. So it's getting better, yeah.
Good. Okay, good. All right. Okay, so this is the 4th clip. You're doing well. Let's play the 4th clip.
Here we go.
This is Sebastian Bloemi. He's just very lucky, you know. He doesn't know what he's doing. in Beijing. He had no idea what he was doing, but he just did it.
So what's happening there? Who's talking?
I think it's Dombrosio talking.
Yeah. Do you have any idea where you might be or when?
I mean, it's after the first race in Beijing. It's either season one or season two, but I think it would be season one. I crashed lots of times in the first race. And the second year, I won the race. So I don't know if he refers to the first season where I crashed everywhere, or if if it's the second season where I won the race. But I would say it's season one.
So you're actually speaking. It is Dombrosio, so you're completely correct with that. Yeah. He's basically gate crashing an interview of yours. You were in Malaysia, so it was the race after. Yeah, and but you were right with the first season there. So yeah, you get 2 points for that one now. So you've done well for a bonus point, which could see you go. You could rival Brendan. Can you answer me this question? During the 2013 Formula One season, Kimi Raikkonen had to sit out the final two races. Who replaced him at Lotus?
Yes, I know.
Go on.
Kovalainen.
Yes, that is well done. That is, I was really not expecting you'd get that. That was, yeah.
Is that top of the leaderboard?
Well, let me do a cut. That's
because I was discussing for that seat back then.
Oh, really, were you?
Yes, yeah, that's what I remember.
Oh, a sore memory, perhaps. Sorry to bring that up. right, let me count that up. So that is 1, 2, 3.
Got to beat Brendan.
Oh, right, okay. The scores are in. So currently at the top of the leaderboard is Brendan with 12.5 points. Bottom of the leaderboard is Corinne Chandhok with 3.5. Yeah, a bit of a nightmare.
Terrible.
And then equal second, third, fourth, and fifth is Oliver Webb, Mark Priestley, Mark Blundell, and Jenny Gout with 12. And I'm afraid, Sebastian, you come in just under that with 11 points.
Oh, it was a good effort.
It was a good effort.
It was a good effort. Another round of applause.
A solid sixth place in our leaderboard with 11 points. So that is very respectable, I must say.
Well done. You have successfully passed the hardest quiz in motorsport, the famous Motor Mouths. Listen, we've got one or two more questions for you. Something that I'm intrigued about and something I like to ask racing drivers. Who's the best driver you've ever shared a track with?
I would say the problem is if you don't drive with the same car, it's difficult to say, but I would say Fernando, because I shared the same car than him. And I'm able to assess, let's say, a bit better than racing against someone that is not in the same car than me, you know. But I would say Fernando for many different kind of reasons. But yeah, I would say him.
To race against Alonso must be pretty epic in any sense, even if you're not in the same team as him. But what's the perhaps proudest moment of your career to date? Tough. There's a lot of things to choose from.
Yeah, it's difficult because it depends at what stage of your career you. There is three things that comes to my mind. My first race, I would say, in Formula One, where I finished seventh. I had a very nice race. I was quick, able to pass people. So I would say my first race in F1, or maybe my third race in China, where, you know, I overtook Ferrari. I think Kimi overtook Lewis with the McLaren on the wet. It was a pretty good moment. But then, you know, winning Le Mans, winning the championship in Formula E, it's a bit difficult to choose because it... Maybe then Le Mans, really, because it was the toughest one to get.
Mm. What are you absolutely rubbish at?
I think cooking, I'm really not good. I can just survive, let's say.
Do you have a signature dish that you can just about get away with, or is it a complete no-go?
Beans on toast.
No, I can survive. But let's say when I have my kids and I have to make dinner, I'll go for the tortellini. So I just warm them up the pasta and that's it. Because I can't handle the kids plus the food. No good.
Easily done. what would you say is perhaps the most uncertain part of your racing career so far? Where you weren't sure what your next move was?
Maybe actually after Formula, I mean, in 2012, maybe just before I got the seat at Toyota, I didn't really know, should I try to go to DTM? I was in touch with DTM. should I try just to remain a reserve driver for Red Bull for 1 year and see? Should I really push for WEC or try to go to IndyCar? I had no idea what to do, really. I was a bit weighing up the options, and then I'm happy because I think what I chose was the right decision.
Would you ever consider IndyCar? I'm a big fan and love the Indy 500. Is that a championship you'd ever think about?
Yeah, to be honest, I like Indy 500. I like everything, but you know, I'm at one point in my career where I'm sharing it with the WEC, Formula E, Formula One. So I have absolutely no time to do something else, which means if I wanted to do that, first of all, I would need to get a seat, which is today not so easy. And then I would have to stop everything and I would have to most likely move to America. And somehow it wouldn't be the right thing to do right now with the contracts I have and the family and everything. So I'm a fan, but I don't see myself in the very near future, other than if something big happens, you know, doing that.
And one of our highbrow questions, do you have any talents that nobody knows about in the public? Can you secretly play the guitar? Are you a wizard on the drums? What are you great at outside of racing cars?
Great. It's a big thing. I can ski quite well, let's say, just okay. Because I was born, you know,
Yeah, you're not afraid of a black run?
No, definitely not. I can play ping pong quite well, but you know, other than that, it's hard to say.
Ping pong, that's a challenge in itself. Now, Seb, what we normally do is we have the same three questions that we ask to everybody at the end of the podcast. And actually, Tim, I've thought of another one that
okay.
I want to ask.
So a final four.
And this is off the back of you chatting about IndyCars. So these are sort of final four questions. If there was, you know, nothing holding you back, what other racing series would you want to race in that you've never really experienced before? And there was a seat on offer and everything was going swimmingly. What racing series would you go and race in that you haven't raced in already?
Yeah, I think I would do IndyCar because I know I would be able to be competitive. I know that. If it's nothing about results, I would try to do rally. You know, where I come from, there is a very famous rally, Rally du Valais, and it's in the European Championship. And I've been watching it quite a bit. And I always thought one day I'm going to try to do it, but I want to do it well. So I need to obviously practice and do the right things. But yeah, without looking at results, I would say rally. If I wanted to be competitive, I think the only option really would be IndyCar.
Okay, interesting. So go on, Tim, take it away with the next one.
What's got you excited at the moment?
I'm normally going to get a new car. Hopefully I'm going to close the deal. So I'm going to get an LFA, Lexus LFA.
Very nice. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
You heard of that?
Yes.
It's a pretty old car now, but it's a car I used to like very much.
Yeah,
when I was there.
It's an absolute beast. It sounds amazing. I used to do some work.
Yeah, the sound is amazing.
I did some work previously with Toyota Gazoo Racing and have worked with Lexus as well. So I'm very familiar with that car. It's an absolute beast.
Just so I had the guy on the phone today trying to close the deal. So hopefully I'll get the answer.
What color are you going for?
The problem is, you know, they all produced, so it's not the color I was looking for, but it's, you know, I have to accept some compromises. So it's a blue.
Nice.
It's a blue.
Not bad. Well, fingers crossed for that. If you weren't doing what you're doing now in all these racing series and race being a racing driver, what would you be doing? Is there another career path you might have taken?
Hard to say. Maybe I would have tried to ski, you know, just because when I was a kid, I loved it and it was quite easy for me to practice, you know, just because I lived like 15 minutes away from the slopes. But I think I would just work in the family business. You know, we have a dealership with my parents and I might be working there. I don't know. It's hard to say because, again, since I was 5 years old, somehow my whole life was only about racing, you know, so it's a bit difficult to think about something else.
And our final question for you, Sebastian, what are you scared of?
I'm scared of sharks. I don't know why. You know, I've never been with sharks, and the probability to find one.
Normally we get spiders. Sharks. Normally people say spiders.
That's a good one.
Exactly. No spiders. No problem. You know, but
sharks. That's a good one. That's a good one. I think we had someone that said killer whales a while back.
I think it was Seen Through Glass.
Yeah, Sam from Seen Through Glass. Scared of killer whales. Really random.
Wow, sharks. Fair enough. Have you? I don't know. I would want to come across one.
When I was a kid, you know, my parents, they brought me to a place in Nice, you know, where you can see the sharks. You know, there's just a glass and you can basically touch them. And somehow I was maybe 6 or 7 and I remember it very well. And I kind of got scared from there. I don't know why.
Scarred for life. That just about brings us to the end.
Thank you for all your time. Great to hear your story. Best of luck for the future. And I'm sure we'll bump into you in a paddock soon.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for listening and giving up your time for us. We'll be back with another episode soon. If you've missed any of the previous episodes, you can take a hop back in your chosen podcast player and find them all there. And don't forget, there's also loads more content on MMTV and the Motormouth app available to download on any device now. And to continue to allow us to help create lots of cool content and to keep making these podcasts, we wanted to let you know about our new Patreon program and how you can join. It just starts from £5 a month to 10 or 20. Each tier allows you slightly different levels of access depending on which one you choose. You can enjoy early access to podcast episodes, exclusive member benefits, merchandise, shout outs, and your chance to feature on one of our shows. Any support you can give us is massively appreciated and will help us grow and continue to bring cool content to race fans all over the world. Just search for us on patreon.com, or you can find out all the details across our socials. On Twitter, it's @Motormouth_, Instagram @Motormouth_official, and on Facebook, just search Motormouth. Like, subscribe and review if you feel so inclined as well. It really helps people to find the podcast. But in the meantime, from myself and Tim, we'll catch you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.